Okay, great. So I want to thank all the organizers for having me give a talk at this group. And I'm a chemist, so the flavor is going to be somewhat different. You've heard something about nanocrystals also yesterday from Olivasados, and these are similar. What I'm going to talk about are somewhat of an overview of the material itself. Then I want to focus on three topics. Some experiments we've done in the last few years. Let me see if it's actually on. Okay, do I need to speak louder? Okay. Okay, so experiments on doing spectroscopy on single nanocrystals that show effects that are confusing and interesting and with my background in statistical mechanics, interesting to me at least. Then from the speculations as to what some of the effects are in here, that led us to do experiments on trying to understand them back to ensemble measurements of trying to inject charges in these materials and then doing experiments looking at the effect of charge on spectra of these materials. And that's going to be this topic here. And the final topic is a topic that in this particular field of nanocrystals, we worked on for 10 years about. And unlike the self-assembled quantum dots, where lasing came about a number of years ago, for the nanocrystal dots, it took a long time for us to be able to finally get these things to lase. And I'm going to talk about why that was for these particular materials and where we are now. And that's the final topic here. OK, so the material that I'm talking about over the last 10, 15 years has been developed so that it's a solution chemistry so that the core part is now pretty much under control. We can make a lot of different materials. A lot of groups around the world can make different materials of different sizes, up to about 10 nanometers in one of the longest dimensions, maybe, of different shapes. We can make, you heard about rods yesterday. People can make disks, triangles. Spheres is the usual one. And then as you work your way out, usually in the architecture, you have some sort of layer on the outside that's probably also inorganic. That's usually also inorganic. That serves as a protective layer. And then on the very outside, you have organic layers that can then be functionalized to bind to other things. And as you make your way from the inside to the outside, the amount of control gets less and less. Okay, so there's a lot of work to be done still. It's not clear when you read the papers, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done on the outside here. It's really not very well controlled at this point. We need to get organic chemists interested in the problem, basically. Okay, this is slide here is just to acknowledge all the work that Chris Murray, who's now at IBM, has done in this field of developing the basic methodology that all of us use. And he's been active with cobalt and magnetic materials in the last few years as he's been there. The reason why this material, particular material, is what all of us really work on is because it's so colorful. It's very pretty to go in the lab and shine light on these things and see beautiful colors come out. And so this is the quantum size effect from 1.5 nanometers to 8 nanometers of these small particles in solution. And as you change your material to, say, cadmium selenide to cadmium telluride, you go further and further red. You can go further and further blue with the other two sixes. And if you go even to the 3.5s in your marcenide or indium phosphide, you can go further to the red. So there's a lot of flexibility in the material itself. And because most of these materials are direct band gap semiconductors, it turns out that if you understand cadmium selenide or the subtleties of what's going on here, you probably have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen with the other colors. And so for the most part, this material here has become sort of the hydrogen atom of this field, of the nanocrystal, the chemically grown nanocrystal field, because it's so easy to make. They're just like dye molecules. They're essentially pigments. And so one of the things that we like to play with is colors, mixing colors. There's an artistic component to the work here. These are particles that are embedded in polymer. You can embed them in all sorts of materials, polymers, sol gels, glasses. This is just the color diagram of what the eye can see here. On the outside are the saturated colors. Most of your computer screens see a triangle that's about this large here. And everything inside this triangle is what the computer can can recover. And because our line widths in fluorescence are very narrow, we actually are able to map a much larger region of what the eye can see here. The eye sees in essentially three bands of colors, and by mixing two or three colors together, you can access anything that the eye can see. And that's interesting and potentially powerful. Okay, now let me go to a slight diversion of the magnetic nanocrystals. There's a lot of talks on spin, and as I mentioned, Chris Murray at IBM is doing a lot of work on this, and we've also done work on this ourselves. And the reason is it's the same sort of chemistry that's used to make the semiconductor work that I'm going to talk about is also used to make cobalt or other magnetic materials. So this is cobalt spheres of that are about 3 nanometers in diameter, clearly showing blocking temperature, less than room temperature, so they're super paramagnetic above a certain temperature, 100 degrees Kelvin for this particle size, ferromagnetic below that temperature. There's the control over the shape of the particle. These are little rods of cobalt here that are all aligned in the direction of a magnetic field because they're ferromagnetic, even though they're very small because of this of the shape and isotropy. And you can change the length of those rods from pretty short to longer, to much longer. So they're essentially wires. Some of the wires are half a micron in length. And that becomes interesting because they're essentially single crystal cobalt magnetic wires. And as a chemist, not knowing too much about physics, I think this is probably an interesting material to try to combine with spin transport to try to do some experiments there. So I'm looking forward to collaborating with people on these sorts of materials. Okay, the work on the single semiconductor spectroscopy I want to talk about really started out with Stephen Pedicles in my group and Manoj Nirmal. I've had collaborators at Bell Labs, Jay Troutman, Lou Bruce, Tim Harris. And recently it's been mostly the work of Ken Shimizu that I'm going to talk about. Okay, so for these, when we started doing this work, people had started to see single quantum dots of the epitaxial kind, and single molecule spectroscopy about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, was beginning to be important. And we decided this was going to be very important for us because unlike single molecules that are all identical, the dots are all somewhat different. And so in order to really get at the intrinsic properties of the dots, we were going to have to look at them one at a time. The line widths and from the spectroscopic point of view were just too broad. And so it turns out that it's pretty easy to see these single quantum dots. This is an image now just with a straight far-field microscope of single quantum dots emitting light. And you can take the spectra. So this is the exciton spectrum from the single dot. This is an LO phonon vibration replica here. And the line widths are very narrow. At low temperature, they are as narrow as our resolution of our apparatus, as long as we don't way too long. And so when we started doing the experiments, there are two effects that we saw immediately that were unexpected, but in retrospect, maybe we should have expected them. The first effect was the fact that these particles were actually not stable. This is what you saw when you look in the microscope, that the particles were blinking on and off. And so even though you're exciting them constantly, uniformly, and with a CW laser, this is what they do. So this really wasn't expected from ensemble measurements. And that was the first puzzle we wanted to try to explain what was going on in these things. It really turned on and off.
Is it correct time?
That's about the correct time, right. The speculation, that was a loop. So, but it goes on for hours, right? The speculation, matter of how much memory you want to put on the computer. So the speculation, based on the work of Sasha Efros, really talking to him, was that what was happening in our experiment, and we have more confirmation of that now, is that the particles were photoionizing from both the light effects and the thermal effects, leaving behind a single charge inside, delocalized inside the particle. And that charge, I put it as positive here as a hole, but who knows? It turns out both electrons and holes, as I'll show, quench the fluorescence completely from these particles. And that the presence of this charge delocalized inside the particle then caused a very efficient quenching of an exciton that you would create in there. So exciton annihilation through transfer of that energy to this charge, which then goes up its energy ladder and comes back down non-radiatively very efficiently. In a process that's probably on the order of 100 picoseconds or so. So the rate for that process is very fast compared to the radiative rate, and therefore the particles become dark. And then there's a random process of neutralization when the ionized charge, which is probably trapped on the surface here, comes back, and then you have your neutral particle again. Or you can get a charge from the outside coming in to neutralize it, and then you're left with a particle that's decorated with charges. And so that gives rise to the possibility that the system that we're looking at is actually, it may be neutral on the inside, but there may be a number of trapped charges on the outside. And these charges then give rise to Stark field, or electric fields, and that can explain then the second observation, which is that the energy of emission, the energy of the states that you're looking at, are really fluctuating over time. So this is now a time trace of that 10 degrees Kelvin of the energy in the y-axis here, and you see this energy sort of fluctuating, sometimes very rapidly, sometimes it's very stable. This is when it turns off. And so we speculated that these sort of fluctuations were due to these random fluctuations of the position of the charges that had been trapped on the outside of the particles. And we can correlate then, what we found is that we could correlate these jumps in energy with times where the particle is not able to emit. So this is a charging, an ionization process giving rise to a charged particle, neutralization. And so between the two states where the particle is neutral, you expect that the charge configuration around the particle then should be somewhat different because of this process. And therefore, the Stark field, the local field, should have been altered. And in fact, you see that it's somewhat stable here, and then it turns off and comes back at a different energy. It's much more clear right in this blinking process here. OK, so I'm trying to build up a sort of a model. And now let's go back to this blinking effect to try to understand a little bit more what if we can figure out some physics behind there. So at 300 degrees Kelvin and 10 degrees Kelvin, it's very clear that you see a difference between these traces of a single dot here. If you blow up the 300 degrees Kelvin, this is 3,000 seconds here. If you blow up to a shorter time scale, however, you find that it doesn't look that different between 300 degrees and 10 degrees Kelvin. There's some self-similarity between these two things. And so one wants to figure out why that is, what's going on here. OK, it turns out that if you plot essentially a histogram on a log-log scale of the probability distribution of having a particular off time, how long this segment stays off, you find that regardless of the dot that you're looking at, you find that it follows a power law. So the distribution of off times then fits a power law. So that was good. This was figured out by Ken Kuno, a former student of mine working with Dave Nesbitt at Colorado. With a power that's reasonably close to -3/2, I don't know whether that's significant or not, that particular number. OK, so you have a number now to try to explain these fluctuations. And so when you do that, you try to change things to change the number. And so we try to change the quantum confinement of the particle by changing the size of the particle. We try to change the quality of the surface, essentially what in the bulk material would call the quantum yield, whether there's a lot of traps or not. So these are high quality. These are not such high qualities. And all the data for all these samples for these probabilities of off times and amount of time it stays off follows essentially the same power law. So that's good, but it's not good. It's good that we have something universal, but it's not good because we can't change it. It's hard to explain. It's harder to explain. OK, so the next thing is to try to see the effect of temperature. OK, this is temperature 10 degrees Kelvin to 300 degrees Kelvin again. There's no change. All right. So that's was disappointing in some ways, especially given that by eye, I can tell what's room temperature and what's not room temperature. Okay. All right, so the reason why you can tell by eye why this is room temperature, this is not room temperature, has nothing to do with the off times, the probability of having long off times or short off times, because those are the same. You can see here, you know, there's some reasonably long off times, really short off times here too, so that probability distribution is the same. It's the probability of being on that's different at room temperature and low temperature. So if I now go back to single dots, look at the on time behavior, what does it take for it to shut itself off? I find that remarkably, the distribution time for how long it stays on also follows the same power law. So there's a symmetry between on and off. But the on times abruptly end. If I were to plot exactly the same plot for the off times, then this thing would keep going until I ran out of signal to noise. But I have plenty of signal to noise here. There's plenty of events. So there's an abrupt ending, and each dot has a different abrupt ending to its power law. So it's as if there's a secondary process that comes in that shuts the dot off. So if you take an average of many single dots, you don't see an abrupt ending. What you see is a tailing out of the power law regime, because each dot then stops at a different time. And then you can see the effect of temperature and the effect of essentially the time scale. If you increase your laser intensity, you increase the internal clock of the system. So as you increase the laser intensity, you go from something, you essentially take this critical time and move it forward in time. Or if you increase the temperature, you do the same thing. You increase the critical time, move it forward in time. So you see at higher temperature, there's more of a tailing than at low temperature and low power, where the power law remains almost forever. And so really what you're seeing in these sorts of traces here is that when the trace is very long, you see the effect of this critical time and the on time, so that you can tell the difference between 300 degrees and 10 degrees Kelvin. But if you look at a short segment, something on the order of 20 seconds or so, then you're in the regime of power loss for both the off time and the on time, and then you don't see the difference in temperature. Okay. All right, so what do I think is happening here? So I'm going to describe a very qualitative model that I can't really put any more depth to it, which is essentially a random walk type model. What we think is connected because of the lack of temperature dependence in the system. What we're looking at is a tunneling event between the charge on the inside of the dot to the charge on an acceptor state at the surface of the quantum dot. And that fluctuations of the environment cause the accepting state and the quantum confined state on the inside to come in and out of resonance. And then when they're in resonance, we can get tunneling back and forth. And so that creates then a symmetry between the inside, between the on times and the off times. But you can also have and the fluctuation of that state on the outside then essentially is a random walk state, random walk dynamics. And so I would suggest maybe a random walk first fascist time model to try to model this universal power law that we see. And then I would suggest that for the on times, that there's another secondary photon-assisted process that would be like creating two excitons at the same time in the dot. And the as you'll see in the latter part of my talk, the possibility of having two excitons at the same time, you get very fast exciton annihilation. And that energy from that annihilation then can give rise to ionization, which would then cause this abrupt turning off of the dot. If you wait long enough, then the probability of having two excitons at the same time then increases. Okay, now I just want to say a few words about, more words about the single dot experiments. One of the insights that this single dot experiment taught us back to the ensemble effects was that had to do with saturation. What happens to the fluorescence as I increase the excitation rate or the excitation flux? If I look at on the single dot itself, so I'm increasing the laser flux and looking at the single dot trace, what I'm doing essentially on a single dot level is taking this critical on time and moving it forward in time, right? Because I'm increasing the clock speed, making the probability of having two excitons at the same time higher and higher. And so as a result, that affects this critical time, and you are much more likely to turn off. You have only short on times. So now if I look at the emission of the dot as a function of laser intensity, if I'm just sitting on an on time, I find that there's no saturation of the fluorescence. But if I now integrate over the time scale of a few seconds, I find this saturation behavior due to this moving of the critical on time of the dots. And this is essentially a bulk effect here. If I would look at a solution or a film of quantum dots, I would see a saturation effect like this. And what these single quantum dot experiments taught me, I think, is that the usual explanation for this sort of saturation effect in the bulk really don't apply, but you have to go look back at these sorts of microscopic effects, which really were unexpected before these experiments were done. Okay, clearly, if you put enough power in here, this will also tail off, and the usual nonlinear saturation behaviors will come in. Okay. Let me spend a couple minutes talking about what else we learned with single dots. So it turns out that these dots have a transition dipole which is actually circular rather than linear, which means that the polarization becomes interesting, because depending on the orientation of the dot, then you either see light which is linearly polarized, such as this green light, a green trace as a function of an analyzer angle. That means that you're looking at the dot with it has a unique axis and a plane of for the transition dipole. You're looking at the dot with the light coming out of the plane of the transition dipole, so it's linearly polarized. With a dot like this one right here, dot is probably oriented something like this. So what you're seeing is the projection of the circular dipole on your eye, which gives rise to an ellipse, and so you see a slight change in the polarization. So that means that by looking at the phase of the polarization as well as the depth of the polarization, in principle, you can follow the orientation of a dot in time. So this is at room temperature. This was at low temperature. We made sure that this worked at room temperature. So this is looking at data now where we're looking at, this is the polarization anisotropy. So this is I parallel minus I perpendicular divided by the total intensity. This is what you expect from a linear dipole. This is the theory here. This is the experiment for dye molecules with a linear dipole in our setup. And we see that looking at many, many of these dye molecules and histogramming what we obtain for the polarization anisotropy, that the experiment works. And for the quantum dots at room temperature, this is what theory expects also for a two-dimensional dipole. And this is what the experiment does. And you see that at room temperature also we have the same effect. And so that means that we can do room temperature experiments and in a liquid or in an environment that's moving, fluctuating in time, and follow the motion of the single quantum dot. And so in order to be able to, we have two things. We need to know the phase, and we need to know the degree of polarization. So we need at least three numbers to plot out the sine curve. And so if we take four pieces of data simultaneously at different polarizations, which we do through by taking our beam and splitting it into four, then we can get in one shot the exact orientation. And that's what we do. And this is now a single quantum dot in a material which is hexadecane in PMMA, which has hexadecane has a melting point around 18 degrees Celsius. And so what you see here is the red trace here on which the vector is the unique axis of the particle here. At low temperature is not moving very much. It's pointing somewhere like this. And as we increase the temperature to green at 27 degrees Celsius, then we see much more motion of the material. And then if we wait a little bit longer, then again we see a lot of motion. So this is the first preliminary experiments trying to figure out how much we can do in terms of following these motions in time. Okay. Very quickly, talking about trying now to prove the speculation that the charged dots are dark dots. So we're building capacitor devices here with dot layers with a self-assembled polymer as the insulator layer here. So this is about a few hundred nanometers here. This is a few monolayers of quantum dots here with ITO electrode so that we can look through the material. This is an experiment, capacitance measurement done by Ashuri's group at MIT, where we can inject electrons on this side here or holes on this side here. So basically what we're looking at is the density of states. And we haven't seen any structure yet in these because this is there's a lot of dots in there, basically. But in any case, we can see that both electrons and holes can be injected in the device. And then we can look at the fluorescence of the device as we put on the voltage. And so at early times when there are no charges in the device, then we put on the voltage. In this case here, we inject electrons in the device. The first thing that we see is a very fast decrease in the fluorescence, and this is due to photoionization. So we create this electric field, shine light, we photoionize the dots, electrons go one way, the holes go the other way, end up with charged dots. So it's a very fast process. This is followed by a much slower process, which is the charge injection process now from the electrode itself, and then screening of the electric field. And so we slowly saturate down. This is about 70% quenching of the fluorescence, so that consistent with the speculation that the charge dot is dark in this case here. And then the recovery when the voltage is removed back to the initial stage here. And you can then cycle this back and forth a number of times. And if you're below a critical voltage for charge injection, then all you see is the photoionization process leading to charge, and then recovery of the photoionization process. Above a critical voltage for charge injection, then you see the actual injection from the electrode into the dot itself. This is electrons going in. You can also do holes. Because of the band offsets, you need a much higher voltage to get rid of electrons from the dots itself. Okay, so this is nice because it sort of validates the mechanism for what we saw on a single dot scale, and also as a way now to try to do experiments in the same vein as the self-assembled dot people have been doing very successfully with charged nanocrystals now. Okay. The final thing that I want to show with the charged nanocrystals is what we're doing here is basically taking a charge and putting it in one of these quantum states here, and essentially blocking out, by putting one charge, we block out half of the possibility of transition, which is basically this state right here where we go from the particle in a box hole to the particle in a box electron. And this is the negative change in optical density, which means that this is how much we're removing of the absorption. Okay, and so this is about a 40% change in the absorption for the states that have the electron in their lowest state here. So that's also consistent with a 70% quench of the fluorescence. And so we're basically doing removing half of these two states here if we put one electron. If we were to put two electrons, then both of these two states would disappear from the spectrum. Okay. Finally, I want to go talk about these lasers. These materials are really colorful and very bright if you shine UV light on them. And this is work that was done in collaboration with Los Alamos. Victor Klimov, Hans Eisler, and Victor Krumsundars are the people doing it in my lab right now, mostly. I've gotten gratings from Hank Smith with his student Mike Walsh. And so for about 10 years, many of us have taken these solutions of quantum dots and put them in dye lasers to try to get them to lase. And you can hit them really hard with, you know, at the time we were using nanosecond 10 hertz joule type lasers where any like blood would lase, right? And these things would not lase. So that was very disappointing because the theory that from many, many years ago had predicted that as we go from the bulk to the quantum wires, to the wires, to quantum wells, to wires, to the little boxes, that the lasing should be more and more efficient. And certainly this was true for bulk to quantum wells and for the self-assembled self-assembled dots, that was also true that you can get them to lase. But for these nanocrystals, this was clearly something was going wrong here. Okay? So we didn't understand that. Okay. All right. And the reason why, in our case, it was so hard is because of this blinking effect, essentially. The same mechanism as this blinking effect. To get a laser in these, what is essentially a two-state system, you need to have an inverted population. Okay. If you only have one exciton in there that I denote here, then you have transparency. You can't get lasing. You get to have two. You have to have a biexciton. Okay. But if you have a biexciton, then you can have this exciton annihilation process, which is the same as what causes the darkening of the particle. So the energy of this exciton is given to this charge, to this electron, or the hole here, which is then going up and down its ladder of electronic states, giving rise to a very fast decay from, say, a triexciton or a biexciton to a single exciton to nothing. And these timescales here are very, very fast. They're on the order of a few, from 10 picoseconds to a few hundred picoseconds. And so that means that if you're going to get stimulated emission in lasing, you have to beat these timescales or somehow slow them down. Okay. All right, so how do you beat these timescales? Well, you have to make a cavity or have a gain medium which is dense enough so that everything happens on the time that light takes on the distance that is less than the distance of light for 10 picoseconds, which is a millimeter or so. All right, so that means we have to cram as many dots as we can in a small, very small volume. Okay, so we were able to, it turned out that because of electric measurements we were making, we were able to make very high quality, essentially waveguide structures, because the index of refraction of the material is higher than the glass substrate or the air. These are actually very good waveguides. And so by making them the particles as dense as possible, so essentially this is like an 18% by volume fraction density of particles, then using a femtosecond laser so that we pump everything at once, so the distance from one side of the excitation to the other is less than a few millimeters, then finally we were able to see simulated emission as a function of excitation power with a threshold effect that's very clear here. Okay, this was at 80 degrees Kelvin, and so because this is essentially a two-level system, it shouldn't really have a temperature dependence. So we went to room temperature, and the problem with room temperature was that the dots were oblated away. Okay, that was not good. Essentially, after two pulses or so, there was no material left. Okay, so that meant that we had to do chemistry, right? These dots here have very soft organic stuff in between them, and they just fly off. All right, so what we had to invent was a way to put the dots in a glass film with the same sort of high density. And so we put the dots in essentially a titanium matrix. There's an AFM of the top of the titanium matrix here. And we can the advantage of actually of titanium is that it has a high refractive index. So by changing the composition of the quantum dot to titanium, we can tune the refractive index by a fair amount here, which is good if you're going to put these things in a cavity where you have to match the refractive index to the resonance of the cavity. And we can make films of arbitrary thickness, essentially. All right, so once you do that, then you can go back to room temperature. Now you have a material that's not going to fly off when you heat it up a little bit. And we go back, and these are two different colors, big dots and small dots. The dotted lines are the fluorescence, and the solid lines are now the stimulated emissions from these films. The next step is to put a cavity in there. And once you get it to work for one color and one sample, then it becomes routine to do. So this is just a whole bunch of different samples, really marching along the visible. We know we also have green. I think there's something. The black line here is much more green. So from green to very deep red. Okay, and you can play games because this is pretty. This now becomes very easy processing, right? So this is a case where we've put in three layers with a buffer layer in between two different colors, with the stimulated emission coming from the side here, and there's no crosstalk between these two layers. We could make them crosstalk by changing the composition of this buffer layer, but in this case here, we just wanted to demonstrate that we could have multicolors coming out at the same time from the small, same little device. Okay, all right. So the next step now is to put in a cavity. First of all, let me tell you that the width of the gain medium is very narrow, so that's why we really have to know exactly what the refractive index of the material is, so that we can match the refractive index to the period of a DFB, for instance. We have to get that right on. Okay, so putting this film on top of a DFB, this is below threshold. This is right at threshold here. This is above threshold. You see the stop band of the DFB, with two little modes on either side of the stop band. As soon as you reach threshold, then one of the modes kicks in and becomes essentially starts to lase. And when you're way above threshold here, this is on a log plot now here, you clearly see a nice laser beam coming out. And this is the laser beam, and this is the SEM of the film on top of the DFB. And you can see it's not great. We still have a lot of ways to go to make it better. But it's good enough that now we have something that we can grab. Okay, it took us 10 years to get to something like this, okay, but now we have it, and now we understand why, and we can make this much smoother by playing games with the chemistry and getting better getting better. And we can also begin to play games because this is soft. So one can play games by, instead of having the DFB already prefabricated, one can emboss the thing with the DFB, for instance, and then create these multi-laser, multi-color structures that I've showed similar emission from. Okay, that's my last slide here. Yes.
Do you see this kind?
Yeah. In fact.
Other than bringing a child and feedback.
Yeah. Right. So, this fast change here corresponds to dissociation of the exciton, because light is being applied here, and creating exciton in the presence of the field. When we turn on the voltage, they dissociate, and that gives rise to a darkening effect because one charge is left behind. Yeah, yeah, so I'm going to show it to you. Yeah, yeah. That's right here. This is energy on this side here, time on this side here. This is the neutral exciton. This is the charged exciton. Well, we can't see it because it's dark. We can't see it because it's dark. We can't see the charged exciton because it's dark. It's always dark in fluorescence. Because the radiative lifetime of the exciton is so much longer than the exciton annihilation time that we just have no chance of seeing it, at least with a signal to noise in these experiments. That's right. Your annihilation times are much smaller, are much longer than ours. A few ten picoseconds, maybe. That's the big difference between the two systems. That's why we couldn't get a laser. That's why you guys could get a laser.
Here about these blinking experiments, it's quite reminiscent of what people in transport call fluctuators, or origins of one over F noise. You know, we have large barriers which are more or less uniformly distributed. But that would give one over time
to the three halves.
Yeah, one over time. I'm sorry, the rate.
Yes.
The rate of time.
Right.
Maybe, but I think some modifications give one over rate to the log. The log might change the power. So
that's
might be very nice.
Possible.
To
yeah.
I think if the distribution is not quite uniform, then you can get any power you want, as long as it's one over the alpha, you can get that. I don't know why it's three halves, but
so. Right. So my problem is that as soon as we have to have a particular distribution of energies, then I'm not sure what to do, because it's true for a lot of different dots and whatever we do at the surface, and presumably we're changing some of these distributions as we affect the surface. And so I would say that the dynamics that we see are independent of these sorts of distributions. Okay, so it's not that robust because the signal to noise is not great, right? But so this is sort of a bunch of dots here, these numbers here. You know, I don't know how much you would change it. These are more other numbers here. And also, because we see a lot of dynamics, my gut feeling is that it's not a static explanation, but it could be a combination of the two. It could be a combination of barriers that are fluctuating in time also.
I had a question. How long can you keep a charge on one of these colloidal?
So we haven't done the experiments, but Philippe Giosini in Chicago has done this, and he can keep, at low temperature, he claims to be able to keep a charge in there for days or weeks. And with our capacitor devices, we can certainly keep them also for as long as the voltage is on. Okay, I'm not sure I can explain it. The lasering experiment, this is speculation now, okay? Lasering experiment, the lasing comes from the bi-exciton, which presumably might be redshifted from the exciton. The second possibility is that there's a reabsorption on the blue side due to the absorption spectrum of the particle itself. And so the blue side of the emission might be quenched because of just reabsorption processes. It doesn't seem, I mean, the stimulated emission seems, the position seems to be independent of temperature with respect to the peak of the fluorescence. It moves with temperature, of course, just like fluorescence does.
The sliding over the surface, or when you exert a force, or for some time the body does not move, and it moves suddenly for some time, and it stops again.
Yes.
And the distribution of length of such avalanches resembles very much the stuff. So.
Yeah, certainly in physics, the phenomenology of these power laws is everywhere, and there seems to be a slightly different explanation for every one of them. And I just don't know what the right explanation is for this particular system here.
Yeah, that's going back to your answer, if the bi-exciton shift is significant, then you can also lay down the single exciton. Then it means that you won't have transparency, but mid-plane, and you have a single exciton.
Yeah, you're actually right on that. Yeah, I'm not completely sure, you know, how to say it. Well, one of the things that one has to remember also is the line width actually that we see. Here, this line width here, about half of it, or maybe even bigger than that for the good samples, is not intrinsic. It's dynamical. It's this fluctuation in energy, right?
How long does the lasing last? I mean, do they sort of reach faster
before it comes to the brain? Once we have it in the titania, it's pretty robust. Our problem is that we tend to ablate the grating. So that's the weak link. It's not the dots.
So to follow up on that, so I guess these dots are too close together now to do single dot spectroscopy, but do you think they're still
matrix? You can do single dot spectroscopy if you have a single dot in here that's much bigger than the rest of the dots. Then you can see that particular dot. Of course, it's not going to be active in the laser structure.
And does it still blink in the same?
It still blinks, way? Yeah. Back to this blinking, I should say, when we put the dots on very rough gold, the blinking stops. And the speculation is that on very rough gold, people know that there's an enhancement of the electric fields. There's antenna effects, which changes the photon density of states and increases the radiative of lifetime. So that if the radiative of lifetime becomes fast enough compared to this annihilation time, then we should stop the blinking, and that appears to be what we're doing.